This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents The Forgetting Time by Sharon Guskin. Read for you by Susan Bennett and David Pitu.
Chapter 1. On the eve of her 39th birthday, on the bleakest day of the worst February in memory, Janie made what would turn out to be the pivotal decision of her life. She decided to take a vacation. Trinidad was not the best choice, maybe. If she was going that far, she should really have gone to Tobago or Venezuela. But she liked the sound of it. Trinidad. Its musicality, like a promise. She bought the cheapest ticket she could find and got there just as the carnival revelers were all going home. The gutters filled with the most beautiful trash she'd ever seen. The streets were empty, people sleeping off the party. The cleanup crew moved slowly, in a contented, underwater shuffle. She'd scooped up handfuls of confetti and stray glittery feathers and plastic jewelry from the curb and stuffed them in her pockets, trying to absorb frivolity by osmosis. There was a wedding going on in her hotel, an American woman marrying a Trinidadian man, and most of the guests were there for it. She watched them circling one another, the aunts and uncles and cousins wilting in the heat, their cheeks daubed with a smear of red sunburn that made them seem happier than they were, and the bemused Trinnies, who were always in groups, laughing and talking in fast Trinny slang. The humidity was intense, but the warm embrace of the sea made up for it, like a consolation prize for the loveless. The beach was exactly like its picture, all palm trees and blue water and green hills, with sand flies that brushed and stung your ankles to remind you that it was real, and little shacks planted here and there that sold bacon shark, deep-fried shark in a pocket of fried fresh dough that tasted better than anything she'd ever eaten. The hotel shower sometimes had hot water and sometimes cold, and sometimes it had no water at all. The days passed easily. She lay on the beach with the kind of glossy magazine she never usually allowed herself, soaking in the sun on her legs and the spray of the sea. It had been such a long winter, snowstorms falling one after the other like a series of calamities that New York was ill-prepared to meet. She had been assigned the bathrooms of a museum her firm was designing, and often she had fallen asleep at her desk, dreaming of blue tiles, or taken a car home after midnight to her silent apartment, collapsing into bed before she could wonder how her life had turned out this way. She turned 39 on her second-to-last night in Trinidad. She sat by herself at the bar on the veranda, listening to the rehearsal dinner in the open banquet hall next door. She was happy to have avoided the requisite birthday brunch back home, those throngs of friends with their husbands and children, and their enthusiastic cards assuring her that this is the year. The year for what? She'd always wanted to ask. She knew what they meant, though. The year for a man. It seemed unlikely. Since her mother had died, she hadn't had the heart to go on dates the two of them couldn't analyze afterward, moment by moment, over the phone. Those endless, necessary conversations that sometimes went on longer than the dates themselves. Men had always come and gone in her life. She'd felt them slipping away months before they actually did. Her mom, though, had always been there, her love as basic and necessary as gravity. Until one day she wasn't. Now, Janie ordered a drink and glanced at the bar menu, choosing the goat curry because she'd never had it before.
"You sure about that?"
the barman said. He was a boy, really, no more than 20, with a slim body and huge laughing eyes.
"It's spicy."
"I can take it," she said, smiling at him, wondering if she might pull an adventure out of her hat on her next to last night, and what it would be like to touch another body again. But the boy simply nodded and brought her the dish a short time later, not even watching to see how she fared with it. The goat curry roared in her mouth.
"I'm impressed. I don't think I could eat that stuff," remarked the man sitting two seats down from her.
He was somewhere in the midst of middle age, a bust of a man, all chest and shoulders, with a ring of blonde, bristling hair circling his head like the laurels of Julius Caesar, and a boxer's nose beneath bold, undefeated eyes. He was the only other guest that wasn't with the wedding party. She'd seen him around the hotel and on the beach, and had been uninspired by his business magazines, his wedding ring. She nodded back at him and took an especially large spoonful of curry, feeling the heat oozing from every pore.
Is it good?
It is, actually, she admitted, in a crazy burn-your-mouth-out kind of way. She took a sip of the rum and coke she'd ordered. It was cold and startling after all that fire.
Yeah?
He looked from her plate to her face. The tops of his cheeks and his head were bright pink, as if he'd flown right up to the sun and gotten away with it.
Mind if I have a taste?
She stared at him, a bit nonplussed, and shrugged. What the hell? Be my guest. He moved quickly over to the seat next to hers. He picked up her spoon, and she watched as it hovered over her plate and then dove down and scooped a mouthful of her curry, depositing it between his lips.
Jesus, he said.
He downed a glass of water.
Jesus Christ!
But he was laughing as he said it, and his brown eyes were admiring her, frankly, over the rim of his water glass. He'd probably noticed her smiling at the barboy, and decided she was up for something. But was she? She looked at him and saw it all instantaneously. The interest in his eyes, the smooth, easy way he moved his left hand slightly behind the roti basket, temporarily obscuring the finger with the wedding ring. He was in Port of Spain on business, a corporate man who had done something lucrative with a franchise, and he decided to give himself a little vacay to celebrate the deal. He said it like that, vacay, and she had to stifle a wince. Who said things like that? No one she knew. He was from Houston, where she'd never been, and had never felt the need to go. He had a white gold Rolex watch on his tanned wrist, the first one she'd ever seen up close. When she told him, he took it off and put it on her own small, moist one, and the thing dangled there, heavy and sparkling. She liked the feel of it, liked its strangeness on the same freckled hand she'd always had. Liked watching it hover like a diamond helicopter over her goat curry.
It looks good on you, he said.
And he glanced up from her wrist to her face with such directness of intent that she blushed and handed him back the watch. What was she doing? I guess I should get going. Her words sounded reluctant even to her own ears.
Stay and talk with me some more?
His voice had a note of pleading in it, but his eyes remained bold.
Come on. I haven't had a decent conversation in a week. And you're so...
I'm so... what?
Unusual.
He flashed a smile at her then. The ingratiating grin of a man who knew how and when to use his charms. A tool in that arsenal that nevertheless flared as he looked at her like metal in the sun. Shining with something genuine, real affection, coming right at her in a blast of heat. Oh, I'm very usual.
No, he considered her. Where are you from?
She took another sip of her drink. It fuzzed her edges a bit. Oh, who cares about that? Her lips were cool and burning.
I do.
Another grin. Quick, engaging, there and gone. But effective.
Okay, then, I live in New York. But you're not a New Yorker originally.
He said it as a statement of fact. She bristled. Why?
You think I'm not tough enough to be a New Yorker?
She felt his eyes lingering on her face and tried to withhold any evidence of the rising warmth in her cheeks.
You're tough, all right, he drawled. But your vulnerability is showing. That's not a New York trait.
Her vulnerability was showing. This was news to her. She wanted to ask where, so she could tuck it back where it belonged.
So?
He leaned closer to her. He smelled like coconut sun lotion, and curry, and sweat.
Where are you really from?
It was a tricky question. She usually demurred. The Midwest, she'd say, or Wisconsin, because she'd spent the longest time there, if you included college. She hadn't been back, though, since. She never told anyone the truth. Except, for some reason, now. I'm not from anywhere. He shifted in his seat, frowning.
What do you mean? Where'd you grow up?
I don't... She shook her head.
You don't want to hear about all this.
I'm listening.
She glanced up at him. He was. He was listening. But listening was not the word. Or maybe it was, a word usually used passively, suggesting a kind of muted receptiveness. The acceptance of the sound that comes from another person, I hear you, whereas what he was doing now, with her, felt shockingly muscular and intimate. Listening with force, the way animals listen to survive in the woods. Well, she took a breath. My dad had one of those regional sales jobs where they keep moving us around. 4 years here, 2 years there, Michigan, Massachusetts, Washington State, Wisconsin. It was just the three of us. Then he kind of kept on moving. I don't know where he went. Someplace without us. My mom and I lived in Wisconsin until I was out of college, and then she moved to New Jersey until she died. It still felt strange to say it. She tried to look away from his intent eyes, but it was impossible. Anyway, then I moved to New York, because most people there don't belong anywhere either. So I have no particular allegiance to any place. I'm from nowhere. Isn't that funny? She shrugged. The words had bubbled up from inside of her. She hadn't really meant to say them.
It sounds pretty fucking lonely, he said, still frowning.
And the word was like a tiny toothpick pricking that soft part of her she hadn't meant to show.
Don't you have family somewhere?
Well, there's an aunt in Hawaii, but what was she doing? Why was she saying this to him? She stopped talking, appalled. She shook her head. I don't do this. I'm sorry.
But we haven't done anything, he said.
There was no mistaking the wolfish shadow that crossed his face. A line from Shakespeare came to her, something her mother used to whisper to Janie when they passed teenage boys at the mall. Yawned Cassius has a lean and hungry look. Her mother was always saying things like that. I mean, Janie stammered, I don't talk like this. I don't know why I'm telling you this now. It must be the rum.
Why shouldn't you tell me?
She glanced at him. She couldn't believe she had opened herself up to him, that she was falling under the admittedly considerable charms of this businessman from Houston who wore a wedding ring. Well, you're a what? A stranger. But that sounded too childlike. She grabbed the first word she could think of. A Republican? She laughed lightly, trying to make a joke out of it. She didn't even know if it was true. Irritation spread like brush fire across his face.
And that makes me, what, some kind of Philistine?
What? No, not at all.
You think that, though?
I can see it plain as day on your face. He was sitting up straight now.
You think we don't feel the same things you do?
His brown eyes, which had been so admiring, bore into her with a kind of wounded fury. Can we go back to talking about the curry?
You think we don't get our hearts broken, or break down crying when our children are born, or wonder about our place in the grand scheme of things?
Okay, okay, I get it. You bleed when pricked. He was still staring at her. If you prick us, do we not bleed? It's from the Merchant of...
Do you get it, Shylock? Do you really?
'Cause I'm not so sure you do. Watch who you're calling Shylock.
Okay. Shylock, Hey. Whatever you say, Shylock.
Hey.
They were grinning at each other now.
So.
She glanced at him sideways.
Children, huh?
He waved away the question with one large pink hand.
Anyway, she added,
what's it matter what I think about anything?
Of course it matters.
Does it?
Why?
Because you're smart. And you're a human being. And you're here, right now, at this moment, and we're having this conversation,
he said, leaning toward her earnestly and touching her lightly on the knee in a way that should have been slimy by any rights, but wasn't. She felt a tremor pass through her quickly, outrunning her will to squelch it. She looked down at her ravaged plate. He probably lived in a McMansion and had 3 kids and a wife who played tennis, she thought. She'd known men like this, of course, but she never flirted with one before. A country club man, a man who had a gift for sales. And women. At the same time, she could feel that there was something else in him that drew her. It was the quickness of his glance, and the volatility of his emotions, and the sense she had that there were thoughts blowing through him at 1,000,000 miles a minute.
Listen, I'm going to check out the Acerite Nature Center tomorrow, he said. Want to come along?
What's that?
He jiggled his leg impatiently. It's a nature center.
Is it far?
He shrugged.
I'm renting a motorcycle.
I don't know.
Suit yourself.
He signaled for the check. She felt his energy swiftly changing course, pulling away. She wanted it back.
All right,
she said.
Why not?
The center was hours away, but she didn't mind. She clung tightly to his back on the motorcycle and reveled in the speed, taking in the lushness of the landscape and the chaotic tumble of the towns, the new concrete houses abutting ramshackly wooden ones, their metal roofs shining side by side in the sun. They got there by midday, and having settled into a companionable silence, followed a tour guide through the rainforest, giggling at the names of the birds he pointed out. The banana quit and oil birds, the bearded bellbird and blue-crowned motmot, the squirrel cuckoo and boat-billed flycatcher. An ease had set in by the time they were having high tea on the wide veranda of the former plantation house, watching the copper-rumped hummingbirds hover at the feeders dangling from the porch, 4, 5, 6 hummingbirds bobbing and whirring in the air, like a magic trick. It feels so colonial, Janie said, leaning back into her wicker chair.
The good old days, huh?
He squinted at her inscrutably.
You're being facetious, right?
I don't know. They were good for some people.
He kept his face blank for a moment,
then burst out laughing. What kind of an asshole do you think I am? I was a Rhodes Scholar, you know.
He said it lightly, but she knew he was trying to impress her, and had succeeded.
You were?
He nodded slowly, his quick eyes filling up with bemusement. Got me a master's in economics from Balliol College, Oxford, England.
He spread out the syllables, playing the roop. He wanted a laugh, and she gave it to him.
So, shouldn't you be teaching at Harvard or something?
For one thing, I make about 20 times what I'd make teaching, even at Harvard. And I'm not beholden to anyone. Not some head of the department or president of the university or spoiled-ass son of a major donor.
He shook his head. Lone wolf, huh? He faux pouted.
Lonely wolf.
They laughed together. Complicit laughter. She felt something between her shoulders loosening, a muscle she'd mistaken for bone, and a lightness came over her. Her scone crumbled to pieces in her hands, and she licked the stray bits on her fingertips.
You are just too fucking cute, he said.
Cute, she made a face. He recalibrated quickly.
Beautiful.
Right, no.
Really?
She shrugged.
You don't know, do you?
He shook his head.
You know a lot of things, but you don't know that.
She cast about for something sardonic to say and decided instead on the truth.
No,
she admitted, sighing. I don't. Sadly, 'cause now... She was going to say that she was almost 40, and fast on the road to losing whatever it was she'd had. She was all but ready to point out the 3 gray hairs and the deepening wrinkle between her eyebrows, but he waved all that away with a hand.
You could be 100 years old and still be beautiful, he said,
as if he meant it. And she couldn't help it. It was such a good line. She smiled at him, soaking it all up with a queasy feeling that she was being swept along toward a shore she hadn't envisioned and needed to do some serious paddling in the other direction if she wanted to get home safe. She held tightly to his waist again on the way back. It was too loud for either of them to say anything, for which she was grateful. No decisions to be made, nothing to worry over. Only the palm trees and 10 roofs spinning out behind her. The wind whipping her hair across her face, and the warm body close to hers. This moment, then the next. Happiness began to burble in the base of her spine and rise giddily up her body. So, this was what it was like. The present moment. She felt it like a revelation. And wasn't this what she'd been after? This lightness that came galloping through, grabbed you by the waist and hauling you along with it? How could you not surrender yourself to it, even if you knew you'd end up sitting bruised in the dirt? She supposed there must be another way to experience that breathless rush of being alive, something inward perhaps, but she didn't know what it was, or how to get there on her own. Then, the ride was over, and they were standing there, awkwardly, outside the hotel. It was late. They were tired. Her hair was coated with grime from the wind. A bumpy moment, and nothing to speed them over it. I should go inside and pack, she thought. But the wedding reception was going on in the banquet hall, and now they could hear the steel pan drums starting up, the sound rippling out across the night, carrying its own distinct, watery beat. Drums invented years ago from the discarded cans of the oil companies. Music from garbage. Who was she to resist? The humid air cradled her body like a large, damp hand. Want to go for a walk? They said it both at the same time, as if it was meant to be. Trouble, 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 she said to herself as they walked. But his hand was warm in hers, and she thought maybe she'd give herself this. Maybe it was all right. The wife was probably one of those women with hard, perfect faces, blonde hair that gleamed around huge diamond studs. She wore short, white skirts and flirted with the tennis instructor, so why should Janie care? But no, that wasn't right, was it? This man's eyes were warm, genuine, even. If you can be calculating and genuine at the same time, which maybe you couldn't be. And he liked her, Janie, with her imperfect face. Her pretty blue eyes and slightly hooked nose and curly hair. So, probably the wife was lovely. She had long, swinging brown hair and kind eyes. She used to be a teacher but stayed home now, caring for the little ones, patient and gentle and too smart for the brutality of that life. It was sucking the lifeblood out of her and yet feeding her at the same time. She was loving. That's what it was. This man was well-loved. Something in the relaxed way he moved, the shine on his face. And right now the wife was sleeping with all of their little ones in their big bed because it was easier that way, and she liked the warmth of their small bodies nestled against her, and she missed him so very much, and maybe she thought that sometimes, on those long, long trips, he was up to something, but she trusted him. because she wanted to, because he had that boldness in his eyes, that life. Why do this to herself? Can't she let herself have anything? He was pointing out the shells scattered across the beach, while she was stuck there in her thoughts. She nodded, absently.
No, look, he said,
taking her head in his big, warm hands and pointing it toward the shore.
You need to look.
The shells were scuttling across the beach to the water, as if the sea was drawing them in with the power of its charm. But how?
Sand crabs, he said.
His hands were still on her face, so it wasn't hard for him to turn it toward him and kiss her once, twice, only twice. She was thinking, just a little taste, and then they'd turn right back. But then he kissed her a third time, and this time she felt all of her hunger rise up like a perfumed plume of smoke from a genie that had been locked in a bottle for 100 years, encircling this man she barely knew. Though her body knew him. It wrapped itself around him fiercely and kissed him as if he was the dearest of the dear. Their defenses fell away, like their clothes. And maybe it was some uncanny combination of chemicals triggering pheromones. And maybe they'd been lovers back among the pharaohs and had just now found each other. And who knew why, really? Who fucking knew?
Jesus, he said.
He pulled back from her a little, and she was pleased to see that all the confidence was rubbed clean away from his face, and he was as stunned by it as she was, by the force of this passion that had no business being there, but was there just the same,
shocking the bejesus out of both of them, as if some Ouija board hijinks at a slumber party had summoned an actual ghost.
To have sex on the beach? Wasn't that a drink? Was this really her life, a cheesy cocktail? With a man she didn't know? Who fooled around with women without using a condom was a very, very, very bad idea. But her body didn't think so. And she'd never surrendered fully to anything in her life. And perhaps it was time. She could hear the steel pan drums ringing like metallic bubbles loop-de-looping in the air, and the happy shouts of the revelers who were dancing, and the laughter of the bride and groom who were dancing too, under that high thatched roof. And she was almost 40, and might never marry. And there was that lovely wife sleeping in that big bed with all those rosy-cheeked children, and she had no one she was going back to. No house, and no children, and no husband. There was no one to love her at all, except this warm body, with its quick, steady heartbeats and its burning life force. It was as if the page she'd been living on had been suddenly ripped from the binding, and she was on the loose side now, the torn, free side, fluttering down to the sandy shore, the moon rearing up high overhead. When their bodies had had their fill at last, they clung to each other on the beach, gasping.
You.
He shook his head, smiling wonderingly. Those alive and admiring eyes taking in her white, sand-abraded body glowing on the beach. He didn't finish the thought. He stopped himself before finishing. Having had an adult lifetime of just such discipline. And she didn't know what it was he was going to say about her, though she knew she'd have the rest of her life to consider the possibilities. She had a sudden impulse to tell him something. To tell him everything. All her secrets, quickly, now, before the warmth began to fade, in the hope that there might be something she could continue to hang on to, a connection she might keep.
Keep?
She almost laughed at herself. Even with the present moment grinning in her face, she couldn't help turning the other way. The end unraveled quickly. She was still processing what had happened, still replaying it in her mind as they walked slowly back to the hotel in silence. Side by side, his hand touching her lightly on her back, as they walked in a gesture that was part caress and part moving her onward.
Guess this is it, then.
He stood outside his door.
It was a real pleasure spending time with you.
His face was appropriately tender and somber. but she could feel the wind in him kicking up. This urgency running through him that was the opposite of what was running through her. I knew without saying anything that her desire to entangle and to linger had no chance against his need to get the hell out of the hallway and back on his own again. Should we exchange email or something? Hey, you ever come to New York on business? She tried to keep her voice light, but he looked at her sadly. She bit her lip. All right, then, she said. She could do this. She did do this. He leaned down and kissed her. A dry, husbandly kiss that still took away a tiny part of her. She didn't know his last name. She realized that later. She hadn't needed to know. The limits of the things being so clear that they hardly needed to be described. She'd wished later, though, that she had it. Not for the birth certificate, nor through any wish to reach out to him and complicate his life, but simply for the story itself, so that she could say to Noah someday, "One night, I met this man, and it was the most beautiful night that ever was, and his name was Jeff. Jeff something." But maybe she had wanted it that way. Maybe she had planned it that way. Because there was no finding Jeff something from Houston, and it had only bound Noah to her more closely, made him even more hers.
Chapter 2. "But I'm not finished." These were the words that popped unbidden out of Jerome Anderson's mouth when the neurologist told him his life was functionally over. "Of course not. Mr. Anderson, this is by no means a death sentence." He hadn't meant his life, though. He'd meant his work, which was his life when you got right down to it. "It's Dr. Anderson," he said. He quieted his panic by watching the neurologist sitting across the table, her elegant hands fumbling as she proceeded to tell him about his illness. In the year since his wife had died, every woman he had met was simply not Sheila, end of story. But suddenly he became aware again of the details that belonged only to living women, the way the doctor's eyes were moistened slightly in sympathy, the rising and falling of the soft curves he could only barely make out under the white coat as she breathed. He saw the sunlight pooling on her glossy black hair as she sat at her desk, inhaled her smell of antibacterial soap mixed with something light, familiar, the citrusy scent of perfume. Something stirred inside of him as he looked at her, as if he was waking up from a long nap. "Now? Really?" Well, nobody ever said the mind was simple, or the body, either, and together they could certainly get up to some mischief. That was fodder for a study. Do patients facing serious impairment or death find their sexual organs aroused? He should shoot Clark an email about it. He'd been doing some interesting studies on the mind-body connection. They could call it an inquiry into Eros / Thanatos. "Dr. Anderson?" The desk clock was ticking, and beneath that he could hear the breathing of the two of them. "Dr. Anderson, do you understand what I've been telling you?" Breathing, a word that inhaled and exhaled. Lose a word like that, and you lose everything. "Doctor..."
"Do I understand?" "Yes. I'm not that far gone. Yet. It seems I can still decode basic sentence structures."
He felt his voice beginning to slip from his control, checked it with difficulty.
"Are you all right?"
He felt his pulse. Seemed normal, but he didn't trust it.
"May I borrow your stethoscope?"
"Excuse me?"
"I want to check my heart rate, see how I'm really doing."
He smiled, which cost him something, a mustering of flagging resources.
"Please, I'll give it right back."
He winked. What the hell? She was going to call psych on him any minute now.
Promise.
She pulled the stethoscope from her long neck and handed it to him. Her eyes were baffled, alert. Did this racked being still have a spark of mojo left? He glimpsed himself in the reflection of the window behind her, barely visible against the blazing metal of cars in the parking lot. Was that hollow-cheeked apparition really his face? He had never cared much about his looks, aside from knowing that they had sometimes helped him with the subjects in his work, yet now he felt the loss with a pang. He still had his hair, though the curls women used to like were long gone. The stethoscope smelled faintly like her. He realized why the perfume was familiar to him. It was something Sheila used to wear when they went someplace nice for dinner. Probably he had bought it for her. He had no idea what it was. She'd always written down what she'd wanted, and he'd dutifully given it for Christmas and birthdays, never paying attention to the details, his mind on other things. Heart rate was a bit high, if not as rapid as he had supposed. Sheila would have laughed at him. Come on now, stop examining yourself and just feel it, will you? The way she'd laughed at him on their wedding night. Was it 44 years ago already? When he had battered her with questions mid-coitus. And this feels good like this? But this, right here, this doesn't? In his eagerness to figure out what worked, his curiosity egging him on, as strong as the desire itself. And what was so wrong with that? Sex, like death, was important. And yet why did no one seem to care enough to ask the questions that mattered? Kinsey did, and Kubler-Ross, and he had too, or had tried. But they were rare, and often faced the hostility of a pea-brained, backward-looking scientific establishment. Let it go, Jer, he heard Sheila say. Just let it go. He should have been embarrassed, his bride laughing at him on his wedding night, the stuff of comedy, but it merely confirmed to him the wisdom of the choice he'd made. She laughed because she understood what kind of animal he was. She accepted his need to know, along with the rest of him, that whole human flesh sack of quirks and failings.
Dr. Anderson.
The doctor had come around the desk, placed her hand on his arm. That was something he'd never thought of years ago when he'd been a resident delivering bad news, the power of touch. He could feel the faint pressure of her nails through the cotton of his shirt. He began to sweat at the thought that she was going to take her hand off, so he pulled his arm away roughly, noting the startled instinctive frown as she processed the rejection. She retreated behind her desk, her diplomas on either side of her. Staunch little soldiers in their Latin uniforms.
Are you all right? Can I answer any questions?
He forced his mind back to what she had been telling him, back to the moment when she had said that word, aphasia. A word like a pretty girl in a summer dress wielding a dagger aimed at his heart. Aphasia, from the Greek word aphatos, meaning speechless.
The prognosis is definite?
A cart rolled through the hallway outside the room, liquids and glasses tinkling.
The prognosis is definite.
Surely there were other questions.
I'm not sure I understand. I didn't have brain trauma or a stroke.
This is a rarer form of aphasia. Primary progressive aphasia is a progressive type of dementia, affecting the brain's language center.
Dementia. Now that was a word he would happily lose. Like,
he forced himself to say it,
Alzheimer's?
Did he study this in med school? Was it significant that he didn't remember?
PPA is a language disorder, but yes, you might say they were cousins.
What a family!
He laughed.
Dr. Anderson?
The neurologist was looking at him as if he was unhinged.
Relax, Dr. Rothenberg. I'm fine. Just processing, as they say. My life, after all.
He sighed.
such as it was. For in that sleep of death what dreams may come, when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause.
He smiled at her, but her expression was unchanged.
Oh, good grief, woman, don't look so alarmed. Don't they teach Shakespeare at Yale anymore?
He yanked off the stethoscope, handing it to her.
You see what I have to lose? He raged inwardly. Things I never thought I'd lose. Is there life after Shakespeare? Now that is a question worth asking. Is there life after work? But he wasn't finished.
Perhaps you'd like to talk to someone. There's a social worker, or, if you prefer, a psychiatrist.
I am a psychiatrist.
Dr. Anderson, listen to me. He noted, but could not feel the concern in her eyes. Many people with primary progressive aphasia continue to take care of themselves for 6 or 7 years, more in some cases, and yours is in the very early stages.
So, I'll be able to feed myself and wipe myself and all of that for years to come?
Most likely.
Not just be able to talk or read or communicate in any way with the rest of mankind.
The disease is progressive, as I've indicated. Eventually, yes, verbal and written communication will become extremely difficult. But cases vary widely. In many instances, the impairments progress quite gradually.
Until?
Parkinson's-like symptoms can develop, along with decline in memory, judgment, mobility, etc. She paused. This can often impact life expectancy.
Time frame?
The two words were all he could manage. The conventional wisdom is 7 to 10 years from diagnosis to death, but there are some recent studies that...
And the treatment?
She paused again. There is no treatment for PPA at this point in time.
Ah, I understand. Well, thank God it isn't a death sentence. So this is what it felt like.
He'd always wondered. He knew what it was like to be on the other side of the desk, so many years ago now. Those months they made the psych residents give out the most severe diagnoses, said it was practice, though sadism was more like it. He remembered the hand-trembling anxiety of entering that room where the patient waited. Hands in your pockets, that was his mantra back then. Hands in your pockets, voice calm, a mask of professionalism that fooled nobody. Then the wild relief when it was done. They'd kept a bottle of vodka under the sink in the psych bathroom for such occasions. This doctor now, this cutting-edge neurologist they'd sent him to, coiffed, polished, her makeup itself a kind of bravado, must have delivered a good dozen of these a month. It was one of her specialties, after all, and still looked peaked around the edges. He hoped there was a bottle of something for her somewhere when this was done.
Dr. Anderson.
Jerry.
Is there anyone we can call for you? A child, perhaps? A sibling or a wife? He met her gaze.
I'm alone.
Oh.
The sympathy in her eyes was unbearable.
He took it all in and rejected it at the same time. He wasn't finished. He would not let himself be finished. It was still possible to get the book done. He would write quickly. That's all he'd do.
He could finish in a year or two before simple nouns and then language itself became alien to him.
He had known he was getting tired. He had thought that was what it was. Why couldn't he find the right words for things sometimes, even though he knew them? They wouldn't come out of his mouth or roll off his pen. And he thought it was because of the exhaustion.
He was not getting younger, and he had always worked long hours. Or perhaps he had picked up a strain of something on his last trip to India. So he went for a checkup, and one thing led to another. One doctor led to another. And he wasn't afraid. He was a man who didn't fear death and had never let pain slow him down,
a man who had survived hepatitis and malaria and could work straight through lesser illnesses and barely take notice of them. So there was nothing to be afraid of, and yet somehow he had ended up here, on the edge of this cliff. But not over it. Not yet. So many words. Oh, he wasn't ready to give up any of them. He loved them all. Shakespeare. Salt Shaker. Sheila. What would Sheila say to him if she were here? She'd always been smarter than he was, though people laughed when he'd said it. The kindergarten teacher smarter than the psychiatrist? But people were idiots, really. They saw the blonde poof of her hair and his degrees, whereas anyone with even half a brain could see how shrewd she was, how much she understood, how much she let herself know. If Sheila were here, but was she? Could she be visiting him in his time of need? Her scent was here. He had no particular experience with spirits, but he didn't disbelieve in them either. It was a subject for which insufficient data existed, despite some valiant efforts here and there. Dukas's Butler case, for instance, or Meyer's Cheltenham ghost, not to mention the early 19th century studies of mediums by William James and his ilk. He closed his eyes for a moment and tried to feel her presence. He felt, or wanted, something. A stirring. Oh, Sheil.
Jerry, Dr. Rothenberg's voice was low. I really think you ought to talk to someone. He opened his eyes.
Please don't call psych. I'm all right. Really.
Okay,
she said softly. They sat for a moment in silence, looking across the desk at each other, as if they were on opposite sides of a raging river. What strange creatures other human beings are, he thought. It's amazing anyone ever connects.
Enough.
He leaned forward, caught his breath.
Are we done, then?
Consider it a favor, he thought. You are hereby released from the cockeyed attentions of a disintegrating man.
Do you have any more questions? Anything else about the course of the disease?
What did she want from him? A wave of panic overcame him suddenly. He gripped the sides of his chair and could see her relax at last at this sign of weakness. He forced himself to release it.
Nothing you can answer. Nothing that won't be answered soon enough.
He was able to stand without wobbling, gave her a little salute. He watched her watching him as he gathered his briefcase and his jacket, could see the discomfort her confusion caused her. All in all, this was not the reaction she'd expected.
Let that be a lesson for you, he thought as he closed the door behind him and leaned against the wall, trying to catch his breath in the too bright, fluorescent corridor amid the rolling, unstoppable roar of the well and the sick. Never expect. It had been the lesson of his life.
Chapter 3 Janie kneeled on the pink tile in her best black dress and tried to quiet her mind. Dirty bathwater oozed across the floor, dampening the knees of her stockings, spotting her velvet hem. She'd always liked the dress because its high waist was sympathetic to her figure, and the velvet gave it a festive bohemian air, but now, streaked as it was with egg yolk and bubbly patches of shampoo that shone like spittle, it had transformed into her most opulent rag. She pulled herself to her feet, glanced in the mirror. She was a mess, all right. Her mascara blackened the area under her eyes like a football player. Her eyeshadow left sparkly bronze streaks across her temples. And her left ear was bleeding. Her hair still looked good, though, billowing and curling around her face, as if it hadn't gotten the message. Serves her right for thinking she could take a night off from Noah. And she had been so excited, too. Janie had known it was probably irrational to get worked up about a date with someone she hadn't actually met. But she liked Bob's photo, his open face and kind, squinting eyes. And she liked his humorous voice on the phone, the way it vibrated deep within her body, waking it up. They had talked for over an hour, delighted to discover so many things in common. They had both grown up in the Midwest and made their way to New York after college. They were the only offspring of formidable mothers. They were decent-looking, socially competent people, surprised to find themselves single in the city they loved. They couldn't help but wonder. They didn't say it, but it was there, in the reverberation of their voices, in their easy laughs. If all that yearning might be ending very soon. And they were going to dinner. Dinner was unambiguously auspicious. All she had to do was get through the day. It was a trying morning, more couples therapy than architecture, as Mr. and Mrs. Ferdinand dithered about whether the third bedroom was an exercise room or a man cave, and the Williamses confessed at the last moment that they wanted to cut the baby's room in half, since actually they'd need two master bedrooms instead of one, which was fine. She didn't care if they slept together or not. Only, why couldn't they have told her before she'd finalized the plans? Throughout the day, in between these meetings, she'd found herself checking her phone as Bob texted her in thrilling bursts, "Can't wait." She imagined him. Was he tall or short? Probably tall. Sitting in his cubicle, or wherever programmers worked, perking up when his phone buzzed with her response, "Me too." The two of them texting away like a couple of teenagers, getting through their day like this, for everybody needed something, didn't they, to pull them through? And to be honest, she was looking forward to a night away from Noah. She hadn't had a date in almost a year. The dinner with Bob had inspired her, reminding her that she was not living the life she'd planned. The sacrifices of the single mom had been her mother's refrain throughout her childhood, delivered always with the same ever so slightly rueful smile, as if giving up the rest of your life was the price you had to pay for the only thing that mattered. Try as she might, it was impossible for Janie to imagine her mother other than she was. Her nurse's uniform neatly pressed and tightly belted, her white shoes and bobbed pewter hair, her sharp, knowing blue eyes, untouched by time or makeup, or any palpable regret. She didn't believe in it. You didn't mess with Ruthie Zimmerman. Even the surgeon she worked with seemed a little afraid of her, wincing nervously when she and Janie ran into them in the supermarket, and Ruth's eyes followed an unmistakable path from her own vegetable and tofu-laden cart to their six packs of beer and packages of bacon and chips. Nor could you ever envision her going on a date, or sleeping in anything besides her plaid flannel PJs. When Janie decided to have Noah, she'd been determined that she would do things differently. Which was probably why she had stuck to her plan that night, even when things started to go so palpably awry. She'd arrived 10 minutes early at Noah's school, and spent the time alternately checking for texts from Bob and spying on Noah through the window in the Fours room. The other children were doing something that involved gluing blue-painted macaroni on paper plates, while her son, as usual, stood right by Sandra's side, tossing a Play-Doh ball from hand to hand as he watched her supervise. Janie quelled a spike of jealousy. From his first day at preschool, Noah had been inexplicably attached to the serene Jamaican teacher, trailing her like a puppy. If only he had liked any one of his sitters half as much, it would have made going out so much easier. Marissa, the head teacher, a woman brimming with natural cheer or caffeination, spotted her at the window and waved her arms as if they were marshaling an airplane, mouthing, "Can we talk?" Janie sighed, again, and plopped on the bench in the hallway under a row of construction paper jack-o'-lanterns. "How's it going with the hand-washing? Any progress?" Marissa flashed an encouraging smile. "A little," she said. Which was a lie, but better, she thought, than not at all. "'Cause he had to skip art again today." "That's too bad," Janie shrugged in a way she hoped didn't denigrate the macaroni project. "He seems okay with it, though. And he's getting a little..." She scrunched her nose, too polite to go further. "Just say it," Janie thought. "Dirty." Her son was dirty.
His every exposed bit of skin was either sticky or smudged with ink or chalk or glue. There was a red smudge from a magic marker that had been on his neck for at least 2 weeks now. She'd done her best with wipes and coated his hands and wrists with hand sanitizer, which seemed to seal in the grit, as if she had laminated him. Some kids couldn't stop washing their hands. Hers wouldn't go near a drop of water without a battle. Thank God he hadn't hit puberty yet and started to stink, or he'd be like the homeless man in the subway you could smell coming from the next car over. And we're cooking tomorrow, blueberry muffins. I'd hate for him to miss that. I'll talk to him. Good, because... Marissa cocked her head, her brown eyes welling with concern. What? The teacher shook her head. It'd be nice for him, that's all. It's only muffins, Janie thought, but didn't say. She stood up. She could see Noah through the little window. He was in the dress-up area, helping Sandra pick up hats. She playfully dropped a fedora on his head, and Janie winced. He looked adorable, but the last thing they needed right now was head lice. Take off the hat, Noah, she silently willed him. But Marissa's voice was chattering in her ear. And, listen, can you ask him not to talk about Voldemort so much in class? It's disturbing to some of the other kids. Okay, take it off. Who's Voldemort? From the Harry Potter books? I mean, I totally understand if you want to read those books to him. I love them, too. It's just that... I mean, Noah's advanced, of course, but they aren't really appropriate for the other children. Janie sighed. They were always making the wrong assumptions when it came to her son. He had a miraculous brain that picked up information seemingly from the air. Some stray comment he had heard once, perhaps, who knew? But they always tried to make it mean something else. Noah doesn't know anything about Harry Potter. I've never even read the books myself, and I would never let him watch those movies. Perhaps another child here told him about them, one with an older sibling. But... The teacher's brown eyes blinked. She opened her mouth again to say something and then seemed to reconsider. Well, listen. Just tell him to lay off the dark stuff, okay? Thanks so much, she said, opening the door to a mosh pit of four-year-olds covered with blue paint and macaroni. Janie stood in the doorway waiting until Noah spotted her. Ah, this was always the best moment of her day. The way he lit up when he caught sight of her. That crooked, face-splitting grin as he tumbled forward, taking a running leap across the room and hurling himself into her arms. He wrapped his legs around her waist like a monkey and placed his forehead right against hers, looking at her with a merry gravity all his own, as if to say, "Oh yes, I remember you." It was her mother's eyes looking back at her, and her own eyes, too. A clear blue that looked quite nice, thank you very much, on her own face, but on Noah, surrounded by the profusion of blonde ringlets, took on another dimension entirely, so that people always did a little double take upon looking at him, as if ethereal beauty, located in a boy child, was some kind of trick. His capacity for joy always stunned her, something he taught her merely by looking in her face. Now she stepped outside with Noah into the darkening October afternoon and felt the world telescoping momentarily to the small figure bouncing on his toes beside her. They walked hand in hand beneath the trees, rows of brownstones flanking the sidewalks as far as they could see. The phone buzzed in her pocket, bringing her back suddenly to Bob. That invisible collection of traits, deep voice, delighted laugh, that hadn't yet knitted together into a whole human being. Feel like I know you already, weird? No, she texted. Same here. Was this true? Maybe. Should she XO? Or was that too forward? She settled for a single X. He responded immediately. XXX. Oh. She felt a current of heat run through her body, as if she'd swum into a warm patch in a cold lake. They walked by the cafe on their corner, and the scent drew her in. She decided to fortify herself for the conversation ahead. She pulled Noah inside. Where are we going, Mommy Mom? I just want a coffee. I'll be quick. Mom, if you drink coffee now, you'll be up till dawn.